Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
We are in the midst of the Jewish High Holy Days, with Yom Kippur beginning at sundown this evening. And while food is at the center of many Jewish celebrations, it's the absence of food, a day of fasting, that marks the highest of Jewish holy days. But whether it's the humbling reflection that accompanies fasting on Yom Kippur, or the timeless tradition of bubbies telling relatives that they look hungry while handing them a heaping Passover plate they could never finish in one sitting, food is a powerful marker of Jewish culture and even identity. And let's talk about Jewish identity. When I was talking about that Passover dinner, what did the family you conjured up look like in your head? Were they from Eastern European Jewish diaspora, Ashkenazi Jews, or even Sephardic Jews in the Middle East, North Africa, or Spain? It's important to remember that there are Jews of all races who have converted to Judaism. And for those folks, there isn't a clear historical relationship that ties where they're from with their beliefs and traditions. What goes on your Seder place if your family is Taiwanese? And those are the recipes that make you feel at home. How do you break fast on Yom Kippur if your table was filled with soul food? Joining us now to talk about food at the intersection of Black and Jewish identities, please welcome food writer and culinary historian Michael Twitty. He was on the show back in 2020 to talk about his book, The Cooking Gene, A Journey Through African-American Culinary History in the Old South. His new book now is called Kosher Soul, The Faith and Food Journey of an African-American Jew. Michael, it's so nice to have you back.
Hi, nice to be back again.
Now, listeners, if you are Jewish and BIPOC, we want to hear from you on this day before Yom Kippur. Call in and tell us how you'll be breaking fast. We want to hear from Jews of color. What will you be cooking for yourself and your family after a day of fasting and, of course, reflection? The number is 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. We can also take calls from folks who are Jewish but not members of the BIPOC Jewish community. If you'd like to ask our guest Michael Twitty how to add something new to recipes, we would welcome your calls as well. 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. We're also available to you via social media at @AllOfItWNYC. So Michael, as I mentioned, last time you were on the show, we talked about your book, The Cooking Gene, and you've described Kosher Soul as the second book in the trilogy about the intersection of food and identity. What led to this project, this trilogy, and how does the second book fit in there?
So the first thing I want to say is that per your intro, you know, not all of us are converts. Some of us have lineages going back as far back as anybody else in Judaism in terms of Jewish people, Jewish peoplehood. That's important to mention.
Yes, thank you.
But other than that, the cooking gene is about, you know, me trying to find my food and family routes and roots in the Old South. And why is it important? It's important because our story as African Americans, 90% of us, is a Southern story, but it's also a story that connects to the African diaspora through the Caribbean, Latin America, and ultimately to the motherland. And so for a lot of people, that connection is tenuous at best. And so for me, it was important to sort of get to the nitty gritty of where my ancestors came from, how the foods I grew up with fit into that nexus, and where I was going to go forward, you know, especially as a living and history interpreter and culinary historian. Kosher Soul is about being African-American and being Jewish. And Jewish, I use the term faith in the title, but the term faith is really alien to our understanding. Like emunah, there is a word for faith, emunah, which is the root of the word amen, right? But it's not the same as someone saying my faith, as in something I can take on or take off. Jewish peoplehood isn't so simple and isn't necessarily bound to one's belief system. But the third one is going to be about being queer in the kitchen. So all these different parts of who I am. And I decided to write about it because, you know, yes, there are a lot of cookbooks out there. There are a lot of books that, you know, hint at different parts of food in our lives. But I think there is also room for food memoir, especially when it comes to people of color, especially when it comes to marginalized oppressed people. It's because food tells other stories about who the people we are, how we become ourselves, how we reinvent ourselves, how we pass on our culture and traditions to each other. And if somebody goes, what does gay have to do with it? I said, well, excuse me. I grew up in a society where heterosexuality was inculcated through food and food traditions all over the planet. Get over it. But also the fact that in this culture, and I think in many parts of Western culture in general, you know, queer people have been, you know, a part of food culture since the get-go, for good or for ill. But also food plays a role in the lives of how all of those different groups inculcate their culture, socialize, normalize each other. I mean, whether it's gay brunch, Shabbat dinner, or a family reunion dinner or on the grounds, food plays a role in how we create family.
At the very beginning of the book, in response to a colleague who wanted to make a clear division between Black food and Jewish food, you say that about the book, a part of Black food that's also Jewish food and a book about Jewish food that's also Black food because it's a book about Black people who are Jewish and Jewish people who are Black. Why do you think some people want to draw that clear line?
It's actually very funny to me because it's this antipodal vision. You know, antipode is a point on the map that's furthest away from another point on the map. Mm-hmm. It's like this will to sort of like, when you want to save the world, we create these stories where a Black and the Jewish person get together and save the world. Independent, you know, whether it's Will Smith and Jeff Goldblum or RuPaul and Michelle Visage or, you know, or whether it's Gene Wilder and Richard Pryor. But any other time where these aliens to each other, and that's not so. They were talking about two groups who sit at the root of the Western world's two original sins outside of misogyny, classism, homophobia, and ableism, that are really root all of the other prejudices, you know, anti-Blackness and anti-Semitism. And they traveled to the New World, the Americas, at the exact same time. You know, 1492 isn't just when Columbus sails the ocean blue. And so that we know that, and we know that these stories of these people are actually further back intertwined into antiquity. We really have no excuse. It's lazy thinking. It's lazy thinking that somehow people push to the margins are somehow not going to meet up, talk, dialogue, interact. Of course they are.
The name of the book is Kosher Soul. My guest is Michael W. Twitty. The full name is Kosher Soul, The Faith and Food Journey of an African-American Jew. I want to talk about your Seder plate a little bit. The Jewish tradition is a bitter herb, obviously, horseradish, to symbolize the bitterness of Jews being enslaved in Egypt per the Passover story. You mentioned that you use collard greens as a bitter herb to symbolize American chattel slavery. Was it always clear to you that you were going to use certain foods as the intersection between your Black identity and your Jewish identity?
Absolutely. I started with the collard green thing came from a Seder that I attended that was hosted by Julius Lester in Washington, D.C., and so they used the collard green as my roar. And I said, oh, that's interesting. And so then later on, I started asking Jews of African descent from different backgrounds, what about the horseradish part? What do you use? And so a young woman who went to Howard, same time I did, she said, oh, we use hot pepper. I'm like, okay, that's interesting. So I began to think about what that meant. And then I thought about the zroa, the lamb bone. And I thought about the chicken bone used in the Great Migration. And also the chicken as like this you know, spiritual, religious thing throughout the African diaspora. Kind of put it together, you know, one thing by one thing, thinking about all the different symbols and what they would mean to different Black audiences.
You describe yourself as a border crosser, someone whose intersections of identity create space for you to communicate across differences, almost like a cultural translator. How do you use food as part of your role as a sort of a conduit, I guess is the word I'm looking for.
When you sit down at someone's table and you've never had a cuisine or a way they approach food, you ask questions. And in Jewish tradition, questions are so important. Questions are more important than answers. Questions are really, you know, they foment dialogue, they foment connection. And that's what it's supposed to do. We're not supposed to just sit down and have the food and have a kumbaya moment. We're supposed to sit down and have the food and really reflect and really relate to people, you know, ask the questions that, you know, put ourselves in their shoes. That's why I do it. You know, when you, I tell people, I joke around and say, if someone's eating my food, they have no time to say stupid things, you know, about who I am, what I come from. And I mean, I'm sure for some people that defensiveness, that's kind of inherent as off-putting. But I mean, imagine what it's like to always have to deal with people's nonsense, questioning who you are, questioning your blackness, questioning your Jewishness, questioning other parts of your identity because they just can't fathom. Even though it's clear to me and to you that every single person living in this culture is intersectional. You know, with all due respect to the original use of Dr. Kimberly Crenshaw's term, we are all intersectional, we're all multicultural, we're all border crossers in some form or another. We are nothing like our ancestors from 500 years ago. And to that point, if we don't start to stop thinking about ourselves as being in boxes and bubbles, we won't have a chance for another 500 years.
We got a tweet from somebody who wants to say, thank you for bringing Michael Twitty on the show and highlighting Jews of Color's identity. So there you go. So glad that folks are enjoying the conversation. Michael, I just want to read a line to you that we've seen a couple of different descriptions of your life and your bio. And you know, because the internet, I want you to weigh in on it rather than just go with what someone's written about you. But here it is. Twitty grew up in Washington, D.C. in a Christian household, but around Jewish food with a mother who regularly made challah. He converted to Judaism in his early 20s and now keeps kosher. What does that leave out?
A lot.
Yeah.
A lot. I mean, also the assumption that I have no Jewish ancestry.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yes, you can be not halakhically Jewish. In other words, Jewish by halakha, by Jewish law, and still have a significant amount of Jewish ancestry. You know, for example, Seth Meyers. Seth Meyers may look the part, he may be from the part, but he's not Jewish. His paternal grandfather was Jewish, and he was not raised Jewish. So they're leaving that part out. The fact that, you know, when I did the DNA stuff with the cooking gene, it was like, oh, yeah, and you have like all these cousins over here who have Ukrainian Jewish ancestry, and all four of them have all four Jewish grandparents. Well, what does that mean? You know, what does that mean in terms of my journey? It means that somewhere, something's tucked away. Okay, great. But ultimately, I have my own path. And I think it's the way it goes for a lot of people. It's like trying to explain my origins is so necessary for some people. And I've begun to kind of push back and go, but what happened to the 15 years I taught Hebrew school?
Mm-hmm.
You know, Orthodox, Reform, Reconstructionist, Conservative, Independent Havara. What, you know, is that simple? And then also that narrative boils it down to one thing, religion. I'm not just peoplehood, not just culture. You know, anyone can tell you if you could probably do all of this, you know, just blank slate and do what you're told to in the books. But that wouldn't impart any of your own soul, intellect, identity into how you practice Yahudut and how you're a member of the Jewish people. And again, those are not always compatible or the same thing. And that may be very complex for some people to get, but it's just in the same way someone can have a phenotype of being African descent and being culturally from the African diaspora, Africa, or African America. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So those are two different things. And so often people want a very simple, you know, you might want to put a 140 character Twitter narrative to define a person. And I work very hard not to be that person.
Michael, we've got a call on line one, Fidel, calling in from Jersey City, New Jersey. Fidel, thank you so much for calling in.
Oh, my goodness. Thank you so much. And thank you for your guest. I really would like to hear more about his analogy about food and queer restaurateurs like myself, because I've experienced some stigma being a gay male in the food industry. And I wouldn't like to get into all the particulars, but I'm sure you can discern by what I'm saying what my experiences have been, and there have been many.
Sure.
So, and I also admire so much your indignant posture on this. It really shines through, and I guess it's what we need to put out there is a mirror in front of all of us to really see how we act towards others.
Fidel, thank you for calling in. Michael, would you like to respond?
Absolutely. I mean, first of all, when part of the reason why you see so much testosterone in like the reality TV show Kitchen is because people are trying to prove themselves straight in a field where for a lot of time that, you know, there was a certain sort of role to play for queer people, queer men in particular, not just in Western society, but across the world. As cooks, as food people, or they were the people who took over the role of the wives or women. There's a very specific reason for that. It's because, you know, in terms of most of the world, some form of polygamy or multiple female presence happened in royal households. And so therefore, to prevent poisoning by these women, I mean, this is not me talking, this is just misogynist tradition. Male cooks, or there were there also might be other taboos associated with women and men for the reason why I was a male cook. So the eunuch character often was often that food character. And so to kind of get out from under that myth and that shadow, you see this hyper masculine, hyper heterosexual pose taken by many male chefs. The problem is that, you know, in this culture and other cultures, you know, what makes us such strong people in the kitchen, queer people? First of all, we have to create families for each other that, you know, outside of our biological families. Number two, we've often been called on to be the aesthetics people, the stylish people, the food people, the wine people. There's one book from the 70s that it says something crazy. It's like, it's a book about food etiquette entertaining. There's a whole chapter about gay men, and it's so ridiculous. And I wish I still had this book, but it was so ridiculous. It was like, okay, it was both celebratory and also like, you have to have these people for your party, but don't let them get too close.
Right.
And of course in this, you know, John Birdsall has written a lot about this, about, you know, what it means to be a gay chef or a queer chef in the contemporary American kitchen, and also talk about the fact that this industry, Bill O'Neill, Craig Claiborne, Bill Smith down in North Carolina, but most importantly, James Beard, all gay men, and then some, who have shaped the American table. So it's that's another complex story to be told, and I'm trying to figure out right now how I'm going to do that. And also, always related back to me, you know, back to what my experiences. But also I ask other people, how do I understand this other part of myself? And for Kosher Soul, queerness does make an appearance, because that's also part of how I am Jewish, how I am Black, how I am American, how I'm human.
Yeah, you write about the how we describe ourselves and situate ourselves for Black folks, kinfolk, for Jewish folks, mishpucha, have chosen family, for queer folks. I want to get one more question in before we have to wrap. Obviously, tomorrow's Yom Kippur. As someone who thinks about food in the layered and multifaceted way you do, what does fasting mean for you spiritually?
Fasting is an extremely sobering experience, because ultimately the goal of fasting is to remind you about mortality, about what other people go through when they don't know when the next meal is going to come from. It reminds you about not having the cares of the physical world. It's a very complex and sobering thing. And it's actually gotten easier as I've gotten older. And it's just an issue of knowing when to drink. Right now, I'm already on the Gatorade and water, Powerade and water cycle as you get ready for Yom Kippur. And so that's important. But, you know, it's not that hard when you, you know, so for some people, it's like, oh, I hate this. No, Tisha B'Av is hard. Tisha B'Av is always in the summer, and that's 25-hour fast. But this is one of those occasions where you do what you got to do. You have a nice meal beforehand that's not too salty, not too complex. You have your new, I got my Frosted Flake Noodle Kugel recipe all ready to go right after Yom Kippur. So y'all can expect some pictures of that on Instagram.
Excellent. My guest has been Michael W. Twitty. The name of the book is Kosher Soul, The Faith and Food Journey of an African American Jew. Michael, thank you for spending time with us.
Thank you again. You're always special to me.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.